Smelly-kelly-ky-maka is the thing to say on a bright Hawaiian Christmas day.
It is Christmas. Well, it's past it now.
No, it's not Christmas, actually. You're wrong. Go fuck yourself. Get out of my car.
Can't say Merry Christmas anymore. The war on Christmas.
Happy Christmas.
Happy holidays is the correct term now.
Happy holidays.
There you go.
I'm joining the war on Christmas. I'm going to kill Santa.
That fucker didn't bring me what I wanted for Christmas.
That's naughty.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. So, originally, yeah, we are retired still. At the time of me recording this, we have no plans to come back.
We're as retired as a professional wrestler.
Pretty
we
much.
Always come back.
We come back either when we want to talk about a movie that's so bad that we have a lot to say.
And this one... Oh, I'm kidding.
But this time we figured, well, every year I have done a end-of-the-year best and worst list. 2019, 2020, 2021, 2022, now 2023. Last year, me and Farron...
2023?
Holy shit, is it?
What the fuck?
No! Yeah, so Fahrenheit and I did a best of 2022 last year. Danny, I figured it would be her turn this year to come back and do a best of 2023.
Yahoo!
And a worst of 2023. Now, Danny will not be fully participating in this like I do. I put together a Mike Stolkoska Koska notes.
Paper! It sounds good on audio!
Sorry. Yeah, it's a... Oh, God, you crumpled it. But there's a...
Sorry.
I put together a best and worst list on a piece of paper. Danny will be reading from her Letterboxd.
Yeah, I'm not gonna go through and do like a proper top. I'm just gonna list off movies that I liked this year that the ones that stuck with me more.
Yeah.
You know?
Whereas I do a traditional top 10 and then I give some awards to some other movies like a bronze and a silver tier for movies that were good but just weren't good enough to make my top 10. Right.
And Roger Ebert.
Dude, that guy wishes he was me.
You're
okay.
Right. In fact, he's dead.
Oh,
he really wishes he was me.
We're going to start with the best of 2023. Before we get into that, though, I guess we'll talk about the year as a whole for movies real quick. So this year for movies was... It was all right. I wouldn't say this is a strong year in the slightest.
The strikes really, you know... kind of cut off the flow of great movies. There were a lot of great movies that came out during the strikes.
People
deserve to be paid and the companies didn't want to.
Nope. Yeah. As a lot of people know, last year I kind of had a lot of movies that were in my top 10 that have stayed there and probably will because that was a pretty good year for movies. We got a lot of great blockbusters and also some great original films.
Yeah, your favorite, Halloween Ends.
Yeah, Halloween Ends. But Everything Everywhere All at Once was one of those movies where I was like, damn, this is a decade-defining movie that came out and it won all the Oscars deservedly. This year, I don't really have any strong opinions for what could win Best Picture or anything like that. Because there's been a lot of great, and obviously there are two on here I give a masterpiece score in my opinion, but other than that, like, yeah, it's just been a fine year for movies, strikes and all, you know,
the
Meg 2, and we also retired at the end of this year, so Hollywood was like, well, stop making good movies, these guys stopped their podcast.
Dude, I can't believe that, like, once we stopped doing the podcast, Hollywood was just like, man, I don't know what we're gonna fucking do. We don't have anyone to... give witty commentary to our films anymore.
No. It was a fine year for movies. I enjoyed making the podcast. I enjoyed seeing movies with Danny, friends, everybody like that. So I'll start with my bronze tier for the best list. So bronze are movies that got a 5 or a 6 out of 10. They're memorable enough to at least make the bronze tier for me. If there was a 5 out of 10 movie that didn't make it, yeah, I probably didn't remember it, but most of my sixes made this. So let's start with the 5 out of 10. Let's go Knock at the Cabin, Renfield, The Super Mario Bros. Movie, Transformers Rise of the Beast, Wonka, No Hard Feelings, Blue Beetle, A Haunting in Venice, Hunger Games, Ballad of Songbirds and Snakes, Napoleon, Leo. For 6 out of 10 bronze, I have Scream 6, Barbie, Rise of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, The Creator, and Saw X.
For my bronze, I don't have... You know what? Cocaine Bear.
Cocaine Bear? Okay, that's fair. I have that on a different list. We'll get to that later.
Your worst.
For the silver tier, these are 7 out of 10 movies that didn't quite crack the top 10. Didn't make an 8. Usually an 8 out of 10 movie has a strong contention to make my end of the year list. For my silver tier, I have Creed 3, The Dungeons & Dragons movie, Bottoms, Evil Dead Rise, Air, Bo is Afraid, Mission Impossible 7, Dead Reckoning Part 1, Priscilla, and Guardians of the Galaxy 3. So for those of you wondering if I was going to sneak 2 Marvel movies on this list, no, there is a Marvel movie on this list, though. But it's not the type of Marvel movie that you're thinking.
Ah.
You want to put nothing for your silver tier?
Hold on. Talk to me.
Talk to Me? Okay.
Yeah, that's a good, it was a good movie.
Yeah, it was a good movie. Right. Yeah. Okay. So now for the top 10 best of 2023. I will start with number 10, which is a tie between two movies because, disclaimer, at the time of me recording this, I have not seen Poor Things yet. And I fully expect after seeing Poor Things, it will make somewhere on my top 10 list. Not sure where it's going to place yet, obviously. But these two movies on my number 10, I do expect to fall off because I do not expect them to probably be as good as Poor Things when I see it. So number 10 is a tie between Asteroid City and Dream Scenario. Now, these are two completely different movies, whereas Asteroid City is more of a movie that deals with the idea of, you know, what is our place in the universe, you know, coming to terms with morality, everything like that. Wes Anderson wrote a great little quirky story about this little family that is in the desert, and this alien comes and it takes a meteorite, and it's all about kind of like their characters, their growth, everything they go through. Basically, your typical Wes Anderson movie, but it has the same problem as Dream Scenario, which is more of a take on cancel culture, what happens when popularity and fame goes to your head. And both of these movies, I would say, are well directed, have great characters, have great acting in them. Jason Schwartzman, Nicolas Cage, both of them are phenomenal in their roles. But my big issue with both of these movies and why they weren't high enough is their third acts for me. Dream Scenario gets really mean-spirited for no reason in the third act, and Nick Cage's character does not really deserve anything that happens to him. After a certain point, he's framed for something that happens where I'm like, he didn't even really like do it intentionally. You can tell that he didn't, but he's cast out from society. He's kind of turned into a loner, and the way the movie resolves it is with another dream scenario, quote unquote, but it really doesn't feel organically like it's that satisfying in the end. And Asteroid City, while it has a great, you know, plot going through about like the universe and what is our place in the universe and everything, I will admit the third act is kind of just left with like no answer in the end. It's just kind of, what do you make of it? The Margot Robbie scene and Jason Schwartzman scene, now that's a great scene in general, but that's not enough for me to fix the problems of the third act there. Again, both of these movies were awarded 8 out of 10s. They were very good in their own way. That's my 10 spot for movie of the year.
I have not seen either of those movies.
Yeah.
I don't have a 10.
Okay.
I'll let you move on.
Okay. My number 9 movie of the year, The Iron Claw.
That's fair.
Yeah, I bet you weren't expecting this, but I really like this movie. So, you and I talked about this. We have not really, like, you and I, you are a big wrestling person. I am not. As somebody that didn't know a whole lot about the Von Erichs and their story, this movie really floored me because it's a great take on toxic masculinity and also what happens when one man's dream is, you know, projected onto his family and what that can lead into. One thing I loved about this movie is all the performances. Zac Efron, who I have dogged on for years, is not a good actor, really proved me wrong with this movie because this is probably one of the best emotional performances that I have seen him put together in a movie. Everybody else in this was great. Obviously, I could go on the list of actors forever that were in this. Obviously, you know, Jeremy Allen White, he was phenomenal in this as well. The Bear, obviously. One thing I loved about this movie was, even if you're not a wrestling fan, it does a pretty good job immersing you into the wrestling world. It's really well shot. The choreography is mostly well done. I know you and I had some gripes with that, obviously. I love the great way that it starts off as an uplifting story and comes crashing down in the third act. The ending of this movie, where the four brothers are in the afterlife, made me shed a tear. That was some beautiful fucking filmmaking right there. And I gotta say, as somebody that doesn't know a whole lot about wrestling and isn't big into it, this does make me kind of want to know more about the Von Erichs, you know, more about these wrestling stories. I know there's a famous wrestler you've told me about that's, you know, killed his whole family.
Oh!
Yeah. And you've told me that could make a phenomenal, like, character study story.
No, movie, it wouldn't That be? Movie should never get
Oh, really?
Okay. I hate that man. I despise that man.
Well, like Vince McMahon, who's also a horrible person. That would make
saying,
a great story.
I would say more of, like, the Hart family would be
Yeah,
a better,
that'd be a good one, too. Yeah.
One or even just like events in professional, like there's the Montreal Screwjob, which is when Bret Hart was on his way out of the WWF, Shawn Michaels was being disrespectful to him, they screwed him over, blah blah blah. That could be a pretty interesting story to tell, but there's already a documentary.
That's true. So yeah. So that's my number 9. Do you want to give any thoughts on it? Because I know you've seen The Iron Claw.
I'm not going to give a full review. I just want to give some thoughts on the movie. I do have a lot more gripes with the movie than most people. That's just because, you know, I have a pre-existing familiarity with the story.
Yeah.
And I'm very passionate about professional wrestling.
Yeah.
I'm not saying the movie's bad. The movie's really well made. It's got an amazing story, and a lot of the messages in it are really strong. The issue that I take with it is just that, one, it just feels really disingenuous to leave out a whole member of the family.
A whole other family, yeah. My thing was the female characters. It feels like a lot of them don't get good writing, or at least like their characters kind of put on the back burner.
That's fair. From interviews that I've seen, the character of Kevin and, God, I can't even remember his wife's name. But apparently, their roles were a little more switched. Kevin was a little bit more wild, and his wife was a little more tame.
That makes sense.
So the movie definitely takes liberties. I think the biggest problem I have is, like I said, removing a whole member of the family, and also the whole part of the... And this happened in that movie, Fighting With My Family, and it happens in... Actually, it doesn't really happen in The Wrestler, but when they do the matches in the ring, they try to show it as if, like, these are real matches happening and they're having, like, actual struggles and stuff.
Yeah.
And any wrestling fan knows everything's predetermined. They talk it out in the ring or they plan it beforehand. And I hate when movies try to make it, like, seem like a real thing in the ring, because that also to me feels very disingenuous, just because it's to me it's more interesting to have them talking and being like, all right, whip me in the corner, you know. That's the kind of stuff that I like, the inside baseball of it all, which I know that would be boring to some people, I'm sure, but there we go.
I gave it an 8 out of 10. You gave it a 7, I think.
I gave it a 7.
My number 8, and I know we just got out of seeing it, Ferrari.
Yeah, that's fair.
Now, I gotta say, I didn't have a lot of expectations with this, because I was talking to Danny before we saw the movie. I'm like, Michael Mann was a director that I heavily respected for a while. Like, his early filmography with Heat, Collateral, Miami Vice I like to some extent. But he is a pretty good director for the most part. He's very good at making grounded, realistic films. Yep. A lot of them are deep character studies. I mean, look no further than, of course, Heat or Collateral, his two, like, magnum opus movies.
Yep.
But he had been retired for a while after a string of, like, not-so-great movies. And so it kind of made me a little bit nervous going into this, because I'm like, well, I've been hearing a lot of great things, like, oh, this is Michael Mann back to what everybody likes him for, and I'm like, okay, but he's much older now. It has been over a decade since he's made a movie. How good can it be? Yeah, he's back to his form, and I hope Heat 2 is good. I know that's coming out later with Adam Driver. But for the most part, what I love about this movie is I don't know a lot about the Ford, like, the Ferrari family. All I knew about it was from Ford v Ferrari.
I was gonna ironically say, you almost
And so to take a character like this, an Enzo Ferrari, a man I didn't know a whole lot about, and telling a really truthful, gutting story about his power trip, about how he wanted to be the best competitor, about how he wanted to be the one that had the cars that everybody wanted for racing, and on top of that, balancing a very toxic family relationship, basically gaslighting his wife into feeling like she was nothing because she couldn't produce him a true heir, him always constantly putting his cars above the drivers themselves. Like, there were just a lot of things about this character where it's again, and I hate always making this comparison, it's like Howie from Uncut Gems. You hate this fucker because of how horrible of a human being he is, but you want to see him win. You want to see Ferrari win at the end of the race. And, you know, it's a typical sports formulaic cliche movie. It's not going to blow you away. You know what's probably going to happen by the ending, but there is one thing that happens in the third act that left me speechless, because I had no idea it was coming. And that's Michael Mann at his best, when he creates those shocking character moments where you have no idea where it's going to go after that. And I was left there going, I don't know. Like, I don't know the story. I don't know what's going to happen. But the thing that I took away from this that made me jump over the Iron Claw in Asteroid City, cinematography, the racing, the practical cars, and the shots in Italy on those big open roads. Mwah. That is Michael Mann. Yep. He is so good. And, like, you can tell, none of it's CGI. It's all drone shots or cameras rigged to cars. Like, it's doing the depth of field thing where it's making the road look longer. Like, it's just great. And I know some people were like, the editing isn't great in this. I will admit, there's some bad editing in this. The beginning 10 minutes were kind of rough for me at first.
Dude, the opening scene of the movie was a little goofy.
Yeah, it was very goofy.
But I give it a pass because I actually kind of found it to be, like,
a little endearing. But overall, this is a phenomenal sports movie. It's probably one of the better sports movies you'll see this year. I know everybody wants to watch the big football, basketball star movie, but if you want something that's a grounded character study with realistic cars racing on real roads and an actual character that you can sink your teeth into and wonder why he made these decisions, go see Ferrari. Michael Mann, praise you, buddy.
Yeah, it was. This was a really well-made movie. Like I was telling Hayden before we started recording, there's a lot of the scenes of, like, a lot of shots of the mountains and the cars driving by, and it looks like the test screens that you would see on a 4K TV at Walmart or something.
Yeah,
it's such a beautiful movie. I thought that Adam Driver gave a really good performance. I can't comment on the accents of anyone because I wasn't paying attention to that.
I will say, from House of Gucci to this, his accent has gotten better. It's not great, but it
maybe
has gotten
cared
better.
More about this movie.
I feel like he did. Michael Mann. Well, he was working with Ridley Scott, remember?
Oh, fair.
But then again, Ridley Scott and Nathan Fillion, so, you know, anything goes.
But yeah, this was a really well-made movie. I like doing like deep dives into the lives of like these really cold, callous businessmen.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they're terrible people, but the stories surrounding them mm-hmm. are fascinating.
They are very fascinating. I gave it an 8 out of 10.
I would probably give it around that too. Yeah, okay. I liked it better than Iron Claw.
Okay. Number 7, Killers of the Flower Moon. Mm.
Yeah.
So I'm a Scorsese shill.
What can you do?
But I like this movie because it's a story that would not get made by any other director. Now, my big problem with it, obviously, is it's not made from anybody of Osage descent. I feel like an Osage-centric movie would be better because the problem this movie had for me going with it was being told through the villain's perspective and not from the Osage. Yeah. But regardless of that, Leo, Lily, De Niro, I mean, even fucking Jesse Plemons, like just characters like that pop up in the movie for a few minutes. Great. And this is a very powerful story. It's a lot about like what happens when, you know, obviously white people want to come in and steal something that they think is theirs. It plays into gentrification a lot because they're trying to take a lot of this land from the Osage and turn it into like big oil tycoon businesses. Oh, I mean, there's that whole fucking scene in the third act where Leo's being gaslit by all these white oil tycoons. Like, it's a great movie, but it's beautifully shot, has a phenomenal score. I know it's 3.5 hours. I get people have an issue with long movies, but to me, other than like a 25 minutes I'd shave off it, I don't mind the runtime of it whatsoever. Yeah. It's got some very heart-wrenching, gutting scenes. Leo delivers one of my favorite performances this year to where I could see him getting the best, you know, actor role for this. Obviously, Lily, I want to see win supporting actress because she does a good job as Molly Burkhart. I love how Scorsese brought in an interpreter to make sure the Osage language was, you know, done well for the screen and for the audiences. I do love how everything does feel like it's in that 1910 setting. I do love most of all about this movie that this movie feels like it could go on to be one of those movies that gets studied later on. Like, definitely, I could see film schools picking this up. I could see different Native American heritage tribes picking this up and talking about it. Like, it's just beautiful movie, and it's one of those filmmaking marvels that I hope everybody checks out before the end of the year, because Martin Scorsese, great job. You did a phenomenal job with this. I know you've seen it too.
Yeah, well, we saw it together.
Yeah, that's true. So if you want to give a quick comments on it.
It has been a while since we've seen it, so I don't have the best memory of how the movie goes.
Okay.
I do remember really liking it. I didn't like it as much as you did, but that's just because we have slightly different tastes.
Yeah.
I thought that the story was really interesting. Obviously, you know, the deep, rich history in the United States.
Yeah. Oh boy.
Fucking doing anything we can to make the lives for the Native Americans worse.
Yeah, way worse.
You know, it's a heart wrenching story because it's so fucking depressing to see what happened to all the Osage people. But it's really well made. Like, there was the fucking scene with the oil spout and the natives are dancing.
Yeah, in slow-mo. Yeah,
yeah. I really like that one part because I just really liked the music and like the joy of them like dancing around and everything.
All right, number 6. Now, film bros, don't cancel me for this, but I always crown one action movie my favorite action movie of the year. John Wick 4 is number 6. Now, John Wick 4 really didn't have a lot going for it for me because I really was starting to get to a point where it went, how do you keep this going? Because John Wick, I get it, he's the immortal hitman. He will continue to kill as many people as he can possible. Keanu's turning 60, you know? So it's like, at what point do you decide to end this story and like make it kind of organically just phase out?
Yeah.
This is that movie. John Wick 4 is the tail end story. Hopefully, I know they're writing a fifth one currently, but fingers crossed, this is the tail end because this movie is a blast from start to finish. And it's really good about the arc of John Wick kind of paying for the sins of the past. And also, you know, learning from that, like, you know, he came out of retirement to avenge his dog. Well, okay, well, that got him back in here. Was it worth it? Was it worth him going and killing that Italian mafia guy in the second one? Because then it got him put on the excommunicado list. Was it worth it because he went to the high table, made a sacrifice, went back to Winston, turned against the high table, then got kicked out and was basically left with nothing? In this fourth movie, it's about all of the atonement of his sins of coming out of retirement and killing from the past and leading to kind of this beautiful ending to where he's finally free, he gets out from under the high table, and he can finally be with his wife in peace, which I think is the one thing that this franchise was leading up to. I know a lot of people say, oh, that's a dumb ending. He dies just after getting free. Well, that's kind of the point. He wanted to go peacefully, and he didn't want, obviously, those people to break in, kill his dog, anything like that. All of his sins that he did in the past, I feel like he atones for well in this. But just got to go over it. This movie has some of the best action sequences in any movie that I've seen in a long time. The car chase scene in the Arc de Triomphe where they're going around with all the cars. The Hotline Miami shot over where it's just that 2D like arcade shooter thing. I love that. Obviously, the stair sequence is memorable because Keanu got kicked down all those steps. But just most of all, you bring in, you know, big time UFC retired people like Scott Atkins to be in a fat suit, fight Keanu Reeves. That's really fun. You have that whole scene over in Japan where he's fighting all of the goons and stuff like that, and obviously the high table. And just it made for this experience to where I don't think anybody that doesn't have a fun side of their brain could not watch this and go, that was a damn fun experience.
Yeah.
John Wick's always been one of my favorite action series. I hope this truly is the end for this franchise because phenomenal. Keanu, great job. Best action movie I saw all year.
Yeah, it has been way longer since we've seen this movie.
It's been since March, yeah.
Yeah, and I don't have the greatest memory, but I'm just going to say, you know, I love the movie. I have it at the top of my list on Letterboxd, even though I don't really like to rank. Yeah. But yeah, it, you know, really well-made movie and fucking great. Just great action, yeah. Man. Great.
All right, now number five, you have not seen The Killer. The new David Fincher movie with Michael Fassbender.
Oh, I really
Fassbender.
Want to.
Yeah, it's on Netflix. So yes, Film Bros, I do acknowledge movies that are on streaming services. Mostly what I had going for this one, though, was it was David Fincher and Michael Fassbender, who had been retired after that string of bad Fox X-Men films and kind of been coasting around looking for a good script. So he took a long time off from acting to come back and make this. And this movie, to me, really was centrally the plot, or I guess the theme of it, was kind of about security and do we really feel safe in the modern world? Because it's a revenge, it's basically a revenge thriller in a way, but it's about this hitman where somebody close to him gets attacked and he has to figure out like why they did this. And he basically works his way up to the higher power. And in the end, he doesn't kill the person, which I don't necessarily hate because that's the point of the movie, is like nobody is truly safe in modern society. And it's this great slow burn epic to me. I know it's not action packed. I know the kills are quick and he's very methodical and he thinks everything out. But to me, that's what a lot of these hitman movies are missing. Like we just saw the trailer for that.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah. That we just saw the trailer for that Jason Statham beekeeper movie, yeah. Where he's playing a hitman that is going around.
Just, John Wick.
Basically, everything's trying to be John Wick. But
it's literally like John Wick, except instead of a dog, it's this older woman that he works for.
Dies, yeah. But basically, every movie just becomes an action-packed thrill ride at this point. Whereas, if you're going to do a movie about an assassin, why not go small scale? Because most assassins are small scale. They kill, they move on, they clean their tracks, and that's what this movie is through the hour and 55 minutes. Kills the person, cleans his tracks, moves on. Really well written, really well shot, competent acting. Like, everything about this movie works so well. And it's a David Fincher movie that's going to leave you thinking. Because it left me thinking about, like, are we truly safe in modern society? Do cameras, ring doorbells really protect us from the inevitable? Because the inevitable caught up to the person in this movie. And I fucking loved it. That was a great movie.
Like I said, I haven't seen it, but I definitely want to check it out. And since you said that the hitman character is very methodical, that actually makes me want to watch it more, because that sounds really interesting. I just want to give a shout out to the movie Tetris.
I haven't seen that yet.
I recommend it. You know, Taron Egerton gives a really good performance. It's a little corny. It's on Apple TV Plus.
My number four, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse.
So
I really struggled with this one because I was like, I don't feel like I should place it under The Killer. I shouldn't place it under John Wick. I don't know if I'd put it under Scorsese. But then I thought more about it, and I've revisited it obviously since theaters, and I've been like, you know what, this is one of those movies to where, damn it, a Marvel movie actually was probably better than some of the other, like, you know, director-made movies I've seen this year.
And what's crazy about it is it's the middle part of a trilogy, and it's still that good.
Yeah, so Miles Morales obviously has been taking a center stage in recent years. The Insomniac Spider-Man games, he's becoming more of a prominent role. Obviously, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse was a great movie, and that was a great origin story for him. This one is kind of, like you said, it's the middle part of that trilogy, and it's exploring more of Miles' arc and kind of creating your own destiny in a way, because Miles is going against the canon. Everybody in the movie tells him that he has to go on this, you know, story that's set in stone. Every Spider-Man has its own origin. It has to go down this path, but Miles wants to break away from that. Jason Schwartzman was wonderful as the Spot. He's one of the goofiest villains ever in Spider-Man lore, but he works so well with it to where he starts off as this wimpy asshole and then becomes this big menacing villain by the ending. I love villains that start off as nothing and build to something, and that's something that this movie did really well. But obviously, I'm not going to turn away from the animation. the blend of the styles in this.
So well done.
It's just so well done. Like, that alone is why I had to put it up here, because of all the dedication and craft that went into this, making it one of the best looking movies that I've seen this year. All the voice acting's great. All the character work is great. I love all of, like, the little callbacks, the little Spider-Man Easter eggs and stuff like that. The third act of this movie was great, even though it let a lot of people down, because they're like, oh, it's on a cliffhanger, but that's the point. The third part is coming in.
Yep.
2035 at this point, for all we know. Fucking knows. But yeah, it was a great movie. I do love Gwen's arc in the movie, everything with her character. This really felt like more of the Gwen-centric movie in some ways, because it completes her arc, and then, you know, Miles' story is going to wrap up in the third movie. But yeah, this movie balanced two arcs, and I think it's one of the few movies this year that balanced those two arcs really, really well.
Yeah. We saw this together. I thought it was a great movie. One of the best movies of the year, like,
yeah, literally.
I've nothing else to say. One of the best movies of the year.
Yeah. My number three, Godzilla Minus One.
You haven't seen this yet? I've seen everyone talking about it.
So, I usually do not like the American Godzilla movies. For whatever reason, I just don't care. And it's mostly because of the human characters. My big dog with Godzilla movies has always been, why should I give a shit about the most bland, boring, generic human characters? Not this movie. The human characters in this feed into the story so well, to where I'm like, all right, Japan just clearly gets Godzilla better, as they should, obviously. And this also serves as kind of a good companion piece to Oppenheimer. It's kind of like those post-World War II effects. What happens? How does it affect a nation like Japan? Because in this movie, the American government's not helping them. The Japanese government isn't helping people. And so it's kind of about, like, what does humanity do when it's at its lowest? And it's about all of these people that have been through war, that have been through suffering, that have been through the worst of the worst, having to fight this giant monster that now plagues their cities. And one thing that I love about this is the main character, which I don't want to butcher the name, obviously, he goes through a lot of that, like, exploring his humanity and, like, what do you become after, you know, you need to build that adversity? Like, after you've lost everything, how do you build that adversity to keep fighting? And I think that movie explores it really well, not only in the character moments, but also when they are all, you know, banding together to take down Godzilla from destroying everything. Godzilla in this too moves back to that old, like, that old 1910, 1920, 1930s Godzilla, where stiff movement, but regardless of that stiff movement, he's knocking down buildings, he's got that fucking gamma ray that just destroys everything. I loved everything about, like, the callback to that old school Godzilla. And this is the first one where Godzilla doesn't team up to become a good guy, or isn't the central good guy of the movie. Godzilla's a fucking menace in this. He's killing people. He's the bad guy for once. And so it's really refreshing to see that actually play out in a movie like this. But the cinematography is beautiful. The score is beautiful. The acting is beautiful. The action is great. See this if it's still in theaters, and do not see it with the English dub. See it in Japanese with the American subtitles if you have to. Don't go looking for stupid dubs. Those are never better than what's intended by the director. But this is a beautiful movie. Beautiful, beautiful movie.
Yeah, like I said, I haven't seen it, but just from that description, it sounds, one, relevant as fuck,
yeah,
and also really good.
Yeah. So my number two, you have not seen yet either, The Holdovers. Mm. So,
I should have seen it by now.
I know. So, I love Paul Giamatti.
It's my fault.
I love Alexander Payne's movies, besides Downsizing, which is garbage, and I don't know what the fuck he was even going for there. That's the Matt Damon Gets Small movie, remember?
Yeah, I remember the trailers.
Okay, yeah. So, this movie is very simple. Paul Giamatti plays a professor at this, you know, private high school, and he has to watch over these kids for 14 days. The kids that didn't get to go home and see their families, right? And it starts off with this character who's kind of on his own, doesn't really know, he's a loner, and then all of his friends, not even really friends, they all leave him to go skiing because his family was nowhere in reach, and it's this great character bonding study about how these two different characters, the student and the professor, are more alike. It's about finding your place in the world, ultimately. It's not supposed to be a cozy movie, because it does go over a lot of different things, like, will I fuck up? Will I be, like, the same as everybody else wants me to be? Do I actually have a future in the world? Even Paul Giamatti in some ways, like, am I good enough to actually prove that I am somebody that deserves to have recognition? Am I somebody that deserves to be taken seriously? Am I somebody that deserves to be loved? And I gotta say, I love this movie simply because it takes three characters in it. Mary, Walleye, or, you know, Paul Giamatti, obviously. And then, I'm trying to remember his name. I can't remember the character's name, and it's bothering me so much. You'll look it up. But the central character of the movie. I love everything about these characters in this movie because all three of their arcs feel like they're completed by the end of the movie, and they all go through their own personal growth.
Angus Tully?
Yeah, Angus Tully. Okay. So Angus has to go through with becoming his own man or his own kid and growing up and realizing, like, there's more, like, I don't have to be everything everybody assumes I am. Paul Giamatti learns, like, there's more to love in the world and there's more to that meets the eye than when you first meet someone. And, of course, Mary goes through the toughest arc of all, I would argue, in the movie, where she loses her son, basically has nothing, acts like there really is nothing for her, but learns there's a lot of greatness that you can build in finding others and community and people. And that's something that I love about this movie, is it's quiet, it's well shot, it's got a great score, it is funny as hell, it is one of the funniest movies this year, it has emotionally gut-wrenching scenes in it that made me cry a couple times, and as one of my favorite endings of the year, that handshake is way more powerful than any hug I've seen in a movie. Like, it's just, and I hope you see it, because
I do my best to watch it.
Yeah, I gave it a 9 when I originally saw it, and then it moved up to a masterpiece for me.
Oh.
So, yeah. I also should mention Godzilla Minus One, Spider-Verse, The Killer, John Wick 4 are all 9 out of 10s also.
Okay.
Probably should have led with that, but my
That's
bad.
Fine.
So number one, I'm sure this will be no shock to you, as it was not a shock to many other people. Big bomb went off.
Oh, yeah.
Oppenheimer. So again, I've read the American Prometheus book. I know a lot of people have issues with this movie, and I completely understand that. And I understand that, you know, not biopics don't always...
Can I say something?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, here's the thing with biopics. Everyone has their specific interests, and mm-hmm. a biopic eventually gets made within that interest. I'm a big wrestling fan.
I'm a history guy.
You're a history guy. Yeah. These movies are not made to give every single detail of every single thing. And I understand the complaints, and I empathize with those complaints, but at the same time, you have to understand, you're not watching a documentary, you're not watching a docuseries, you're not watching a biopic series.
Yeah.
You're not reading a book, you're not reading fucking Wikipedia article.
Yeah.
There's gonna be stuff that gets, it's a what, a 3-hour long movie?
Almost, 2.5? Yeah, it's like, yeah. 2:55.
Okay. It's not gonna give every single detail of everything that went down. It's just impossible. That's why I had issues with the Iron Claw, and it just happens.
Yeah. I'm a big Christopher Nolan fan, as a lot of people know, and I'm not saying Christopher Nolan's a perfect director. I would never say that in the slightest. I do have issues with the way he writes certain characters. I have issues with the way he has sound mixed in with, you know, just normal stuff. Like, look at the Dark Knight.
This movie was his best mix.
Yeah, mix
say.
Of it, I would say. Like, look at the Dark Knight Rises. That movie's pretty much not great.
Dude,
but
look,
like,
at Tenet.
Yeah, look at Tenet. Exactly.
It's a good movie, but the sound mixing.
Yeah, but if I will acknowledge Christopher Nolan is good at something, it's when he has one story with one central character, and he's exploring that character deeply in the length of time that the studio gives him, which with this, I'm pretty sure he is given free rein because it's based on a book. It's based on somebody in history that's very controversial, and he went through it toe-to-toe, just like the book. Like, most of this movie plays just like the book if you've read it. And one thing that I love about it is this is a movie that definitely is going to be divisive to a lot of people, but it also is looking at the bigger picture overall of, like, how did this affect the world? Where does it become? How did this one man's ambition blind him so much from what he had created and what has left our society with? Like, we still live in the fear of nuclear Armageddon. Like, what he created has created a ripple effect to where I don't know if we'll ever feel safe. And it's about exploring this man, this character, this person, and bringing him down and, like, basically pointing out how, like, it was terrible that he even created this in the first place. And sure, he had some, you know, obviously he didn't feel great after it was created. This is the movie explores. Like, there's that great scene where he's trying to rally everybody after, and then he realizes, like, oh my God, I've killed all these people. And it's about him trying to make amends for that, but he's not perfect. He's being called out on his bullshit. And I love this movie simply for that. Robert Downey Jr. gives a great supporting performance in this. Everybody in this, to me, gave a great performance overall. Even Benny Safdie with a questionable Russian accent I loved in this. But, you know, or German, whatever he's supposed to be. But I loved this movie simply because it is one of those movies that I feel like is going to, again, much like Killers of the Flower Moon, be studied for years to go on. Because it's, again, one of those tough characters and one of those tough people where you have to kind of peel back the layers and see he wasn't a great person, what he did was detrimental, but at the same time, why are we telling this story? Why is the story being made? And again, it's a reflection of, like, what we learn in the past is an exploration of the present, which I know is a quote from The Holdovers, but it still is very, very true.
I do think this movie is going to be studied in film classes.
Oh, especially.
Because some of the effects that they got in this movie are so
the bomb itself
well done, that people are going to have to fucking study that shit just to figure out how some of that stuff was done.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And if you guys want any more in-depthful, you know, takes on any of these movies, obviously we have podcasts or I have Letterboxd reviews that go more in detail. Yeah, we have a whole Oppenheimer review if you guys want to check that out.
Oh, yeah. I should probably give my number one movie.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Exorcist Believer. Oh.
Can't leave out Exorcist Believer.
Yeah, I'm honestly, you left out Exorcist Believer and the FNAF movie. Yeah. That's kind of insulting to cinema.
So my top 10 best, I'll go over them real quick again. Again, the tie at 10, Asteroid City, Dream Scenario. 9 is The Iron Claw. 8 is Ferrari. 7, Killers of the Flower Moon. 6, John Wick 4. 5, The Killer. 4, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. 3, Godzilla Minus 1. 2, The Holdovers. 1, Oppenheimer.
Do you, want to give your rankings for each one again?
Or? Oh, yeah. Okay. So, Asteroid City, Dream Scenario, The Iron Claw, Ferrari, Killers of the Flower Moon, all 8 out of 10s. All
right.
John Wick 4, The Killer, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, Godzilla Minus 1, 9 out of 10s. And then The Holdovers and Oppenheimer, I give a masterpiece score.
All right. I just wanted to make sure.
All right, you ready for the dog shit that I saw?
Yep.
Okay.
I saw some of it too, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. We can talk about these, too, when we get to them. So, dishonorable mentions. These are movies that were not bad enough to make the top 10, but you're still not a good movie. So, let's start with the 4 out of 10s. Shazam! Fury of the God.
Wait, can I ask, is your top 10 worst, like, the worst, or are these ones that you actually kind of like a little bit?
No,
like,
I fucking hated these.
So,
movies.
These are, like, 0 ranking?
These are, like, half star to 1 out of 10 movies. Okay. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Okay, so, 4 out of 10 movies. Shazam! Fury of the Gods. Fast X. Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny, Extraction 2, You Are So Not Invited to My Bar Mitzvah.
What the fuck is that?
That is Adam Sandler's new movie he made with his daughter.
Oh, I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, a lot of people didn't. I literally, like, I think I streamed this for some people, and
dude,
I don't even
so
think they knew it
existed. It's so funny that this year he had 2 movies come out, and one of them sucked.
My 3 out of 10s, Murder Mystery 2, another Adam Sandler movie. Fool's Paradise, which was that Charlie Day movie he tried to make with the Always Sunny cast.
That
wasn't very good.
Like, Hollywood, right?
Yeah, he's like silent. Like, he doesn't talk in the movie.
Yeah,
it's weird.
He's like the Charlie Chaplin type.
Yeah. Fool's Paradise, The Haunted Mansion, the Disney movie that nobody...
But Danny DeVito's in it!
I know. And he was wasted in it.
Oh.
Retribution, which was the Liam Neeson action movie where he drives a car. I
vaguely remember that. The trailer, I mean.
Next Goal Wins, Taika Waititi's, whatever the fuck that was.
Oh.
And Silent Night, the all no dialogue John Woo action Christmas movie that I knew was going to be bad. So, you want to start with number 10?
Yeah, 10 to 1.
All right, 10 is Operation Fortune Ruse de Garay. You didn't see this, but it's the new Guy Ritchie movie.
Oh!
So I saw this with my friend Matt, and we both walked out going, the fuck was that? So Guy Ritchie, like I said, is a director that has fallen off a cliff and will probably never get back on it.
Let's see, he did that movie, The Gentleman, I think is what it was called, which, you know, I think across the board people thought was pretty good.
No, you most know? People fucking hated
really?
It.
Really?
Yeah, we were the only ones that were kind of passive on it. Yeah.
Yeah. And then he did that Wrath of Man.
Yeah, Wrath of Man, where Jason Statham's just killing people.
It was alright. It was just edgy for the sake of being edgy.
Yeah, for the sake of being edgy. He did the Aladdin remake.
Then he did this.
Yeah. So Operation Ruse de Garay is just Jason.
He's been falling off a cliff hard.
It's like Jason Statham playing kind of James Bond.
Fucking of course Jason
It's all just manly characters being manly and saying the most, like, you know, out-of-pocket shit to make people in the audience go, whoa, I can't believe that was said in a movie. All the female characters are written to just either be, you know... They're meant to either exist to be women or literally have no character at all.
Women be shopping. Sorry. Sorry, guys. We got to cancel the podcast. I killed Hayden by being misogynistic.
You got me. That was good. And the action's not good. I was going to say that next. Slow-mo shots. Really bad framing. And then characters just talk a million miles a minute in every Guy Ritchie movie.
That's...
Why? What is the point of that?
And Jason Statham, of all people.
Yeah, and if he didn't have the nasally complexion.
You used to do a good Jason Statham.
Yeah, I can't do it now, but... But it's a bad movie. That's all I'll say. Just don't fucking see it. Number 9, you haven't seen this either. The Flash.
Oh, I will never watch
some people, okay. Some people are giving this a pass. They're like, oh, it's campy and fun. I get that. But it's fucking dog shit, guys. Like, it's not good. Ezra Miller sucks. Fuck Ezra Miller and fuck everything about him. Another thing that I have to say about this movie is it killed a lot of, like, my love for superhero movies going forward, because literally, like, I think I hit a brick wall. Like, I literally could not give a flying fuck about if DC has a future or not. And I know James Gunn's gonna try to right the ship, obviously, later on, but, like, I literally couldn't. The CGI is dog shit. The story's dumb. Barry literally creates his own problems in the movie. And the other Barry, like the past version of him or whatever, the alternate version of him.
They're trying to do Flashpoint, right?
Yeah, and he's annoying. He becomes the Dark Flash or whatever at the ending, and it's just stupid. Michael Keaton's Batman goes off the rails, and he's 70, and he's still, like, punching and beating up bad guys as if he's the young 30s Michael Keaton, which... Even then, like, that's not how that Batman moved. This Batman is doing, like, Man of Steel action shit. And I'm like, he moves stiff. That's what made his Batman cool. I know Tim Burton is not well-liked as a director, but I will say his Batman movies at least, like, understood Batman as kind of like a real person in a costume.
The whole thing with the Michael Keaton Batman is that he couldn't turn his head, so he was very stiff.
Yeah.
And he incorporated that into the character.
Yeah, and he can't turn his neck. He's just doing the same thing in the movie. Zod shows back up for whatever fuck all reason.
Did you see that interview where Michael Shannon was just like, I don't know.
I don't know what I'm going on. But the plot's dumb. The action's dumb. The characters are dumb. Everything about this was dumb. And it was a big way. It flopped, thank God. I'm glad nobody actually saw this until it came to HBO Max or whatever it was. But, like, fuck this movie.
I saw your number 8. I can't wait.
Cocaine Bear.
Yeah.
We have a podcast on this already. But... Hey, wasn't it funny when the child said cocaine? When the child said fuck?
Remember when the kids did cocaine?
Yeah, the kids did cocaine. Remember when the only joke they had going for it in the movie was people were like, it's a cocaine bear!
Dude, Ice Cube's son?
Yeah, shows up in Ray Liotta. This is one of his last roles and he does nothing.
And the guy,
the police officer.
Played Harrison Ford's character.
Yeah,
and then disappeared.
Yeah. Remember
when the bear laid on top of him and he was like, "Mo guy!"
Remember the cop with the dog that gets shot?
I genuinely did not remember that.
But it's a bad movie. It's like an SNL skit.
It was an hour and a half long SNL sketch. It's like it's literally like when SNL has a 3-minute sketch and then Lorne Michaels is like, I can make money off of that. And then they make an hour and a half long movie and it sucks.
It was just bad. Like, nothing about it was funny. Nothing in it was good. Yeah. Fuck that.
I believe it starts out with based on a true story, too, which is like, fuck off.
Fuck off. The bear died. It ate all the cocaine and died.
Yeah.
Okay.
It had a heart attack.
Yeah. Number 7. You have not seen this, but I unfortunately saw it with my roommate. The Machine, the Burt Kreischer movie.
Oh, fuck off.
Yeah. So the movie based on his true story about all that shit he did on the train,
you know,
fucking college and all
actually,
that.
Actually, I have seen pictures.
One of his
college mates posted pictures a while back. I don't know how much of it's a true story, but at least there is a glint.
So it's loosely based on that true story, but it's obviously a dramatization of all these years later, him being brought back to Russia.
I don't know why you watched it.
Well, my roommate likes Burt Kreischer.
We'll get into that later.
Yeah.
I saw the fucking trailer for that movie and
Mark Hamill's in it.
The moment Burt Kreischer popped up, I was pissed.
Why
are we giving him a movie?
If you like Burt Kreischer comedy, good for you.
Oh, and by the way, the trailer showed before Cocaine Bear. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, it did. It shows before Cocaine Bear.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it starts with Burt. I'm pretty sure you missed the beginning part of it because Burt Kreischer pops up in front of like a red curtain and says, "Hey, it's me, the real Cocaine Bear."
Yeah.
And it's like, fuck off.
It's all Burt Kreischer comedy.
Yeah.
Like,
he's not
verbatim. Mark Hamill barely saves it with the little he's given, but like, imagine just sitting through a Burt Kreischer fake movie sketch.
Yeah.
That's it. And it's not funny through any of it. It's so fucking stupid.
Yeah, if you like a stand-up, you'll probably like it, but I haven't even seen the fucking movie and I know it's dog shit.
So that's all my 3 out of 10s.
Oh,
now we're moving into the 2 out of 10 territory. Number 6 is The Meg 2.
Oh, you mean the greatest movie of all time?
Chomp! Chomp! You remember the song that played at the end called Chomp?
No. You expect me to remember something from that movie.
this was like a sci-fi original movie put on a big screen.
That was the exact quote I put in my review, I believe.
Yeah, and it's bad. Like it's just characters exist to get eaten, or Jason Statham's a hard stone cold badass with I can't remember.
Yeah, there's like five other books too.
Yeah, they're gonna make more, and yeah. I know this will get
because these
sequel.
Make money.
Bad CGI, bad action, bad characters. What more can I say about it? We've done a podcast on it. Go listen to that if you want.
Oh my
thoughts.
God, did we?
Yeah, it was our last podcast was those that. And
oh fuck,
TMNT.
Yeah.
So we begin. Anyways, number five is Ant-Man Quantumania.
I haven't seen it, but yeah.
Look,
especially after recent.
Marvel. I think they should close the book. Guardians 3 was such a good finish to where I'm like, why are you guys still watching? I didn't watch Loki season 2. I didn't watch the Marvels. I'm probably not going to watch anything. Like, my roommate's begging me to see Deadpool 3, and that's a big maybe, because I'm not happy they're bringing back, like, you know, Hugh Jackman after Logan, because that was such a beautiful ending, but what a...
I just don't know if I'd want to watch it.
What was this movie? It was Marvel humor turned up to 1,000, CGI that made my eyes want to peel out of its head, villain in Kang the Conqueror, which is meant to be, like, one of the baddest motherfuckers, because he has so many variants of himself, he's powerful, and he's played pretty well by Jonathan Majors, but... He's killed by giant ants in the movie, and then he's shrunk down to, like, I don't know, what's less than quantum? I couldn't tell you, but that's how he dies.
Is he shrunk down to the size of a cork?
Yeah. Paul Rudd, I mostly like Paul Rudd, but not in this. I don't even know what his character's supposed to be. Cassie Lang was not great in the movie. Her character arc is nothing. Every other character looks bored. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know what their direction is. Peyton Reed's a shit director, as I've been over many times before. So,
yeah, I haven't seen it.
This should come to no shock. Ant-Man and the Wasp is my least favorite Marvel movie. Mm-hmm. So, and I didn't even like the original Ant-Man that much, mind you. And it was supposed to be an Edgar Wright movie. So,
yeah.
Here we are with this. What do I do with this? And especially now, what do you do going forward post Jonathan Majors, all the stuff that's come out? So, they're going to either have to pivot to Doctor Doom or recast. And I don't know if they have the balls to recast.
I don't know. I think Marvel should just cut it and, like, take a break for a while.
This was my highest liked Letterboxd review, and it had nothing to do with the movie. It just had to do with my experience seeing it.
My most liked Letterboxd review was for Cool Cat Finds a Gun, and it says Cool Cat Finds a Cum. So.
Oh.
It's my most liked review. I didn't even watch the movie.
Number four. 80 for Brady.
Oh, dude. I love that movie. I haven't seen it.
Four Golden Girls of Hollywood are harassed by Tom Brady and co. For the entire runtime. Lily Tomlinson, Jane Fonda,
right?
Yeah.
Lily Tomlinson.
Rhea Moreno, and I can't remember the last one, sorry.
I don't care enough.
But, like, imagine an SNL skit, again, turned into a movie. That's what it is. And, like, it's just old ladies get in shenanigans before they go to the 28-3 Super Bowl the Falcons collapsed in against Tom Brady. And Tom Brady says, fuck.
Oh!
Yeah. And for some reason, a Gronk erotica joke was brought up because apparently Rob Gronkowski erotica fan fiction. Again, sports movies, like I said, go see Ferrari, don't see 80 for Brady. But it just imagine a bunch of Golden Girls held at gunpoint by Tom Brady. That's all you need to know.
That's fucking crazy.
Me and Farron, I did a podcast on it, so go listen to that. Number three.
Let me guess. FNAF movie.
Wow. Five Nights at Freddy's.
Yeah.
Okay. Again, we have a podcast on this.
That's where I'm
okay. again, we have a podcast on this, but what the fuck was this? It wasn't even a horror movie. And again, you're turning a video game with no story, really.
Here's what it is. They know that their market is a young audience.
Yeah.
So they toned it down for a young audience. Whatever. It looks nice. It's a really nice-looking movie. The fact is, it sucks.
Yeah. The characters are dog shit. Josh Hutcherson, you know, he tried his best with what he had.
Yeah.
The cop character was nothing. I couldn't remember a thing that happened.
You mean the really obvious weirdo?
Yeah. The animatronics themselves looked pretty fine, but they didn't look dirty. Like, yeah. The FNAF characters look dirty and worn.
So, here's what it is. The costumes were really well made. They were made by the Jim Henson Muppet Factory or whatever.
Yeah.
They're really well made. They look really nice. It's just that they're not dirty. The main issue is that they look too clean.
They do. They look super clean.
For these suits that are supposed to have been there for like 30 years or whatever. That's the hugest issue.
Matthew Lillard was okay as purple guy.
Yeah, I mean, he was the best part, I think, because he at least overacted a little at the end, and that's what you get Matthew Lillard
I for. Still can't get over this movie's big climactic third act was changing the lore. The little girl changes the picture, and they all turn on him with the red eyes and let out the... You don't even remember that.
Genuinely, the most I remember is... Matthew Lillard in the suit getting the fucking spring trap
thing put in him. Yeah.
Yeah. That's all I remember. And like, obviously, how they look.
Yeah. Too. Again, there's a podcast on it. Go listen to it. We have more in depth thoughts. My number two is probably going to shock you because I don't think you've seen it.
Well, I know what your number one is then.
Well, yeah. But we'll get to that. We'll get to that. Number two.
Your number two. Okay. I haven't seen it, but do I know what it is?
Oh, yeah. It's been on Twitter for the past 2.5 weeks.
Twitter.
It's the new Star Wars.
Andor?
No. No, the new Star Wars. Made by the guy that was responsible for the DCEU.
Cowboy hat guy?
No. DCEU. Think about
it. Oh, fuck.
Now it's coming to
Zack Snyder.
Rebel Moon. What was this? Who liked this? Who's still giving Zack Snyder money to make things? Rebel Moon is like everything about Star Wars, but imagine there's just... no semblance of like any organic character growth. There's no lived in worlds that actually feel like a realistic set. Everything in this is CGI. It's all CGI, and the characters are minuscule. They all exist to just be cool badasses, and the dialogue they're given is fucking dog shit. And you know how like it's subtle that the Empire was like basically based on the Nazis? Mm-hmm. Imagine Zack Snyder didn't take any of that subtlety and was like, no, my character, like the bad guys in this are just Nazis.
I don't know if you know this, Hayden, but I don't think Zack Snyder's ever heard of subtlety.
I don't think he knows how to make
a
good movie.
I've never seen a Zack Snyder movie.
This movie's bad, and it just copies a lot of things from Star Wars. Anthony Hopkins plays a robot that's barely in it, and he was my favorite
Anthony
character.
Anthony Hopkins is in this?
And he hates doing movies like this, remind you. It's just pretentious shit. It's just all Zack Snyder thinking he's making something bigger than what he can, and that's my biggest issue with Zack Snyder is he can't make things bigger than what he can.
Yeah.
It's bad. And I don't have to say more than don't see it. Don't fucking see it.
I won't. Don't worry.
You know what number one is.
Can I say it?
Yeah.
The Exorcist Believer.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so this movie sucks.
Yeah, we made a podcast on it, obviously, but taking a beloved movie like The Exorcist and giving it a sequel all these years later.
Stabbing David Bowie in the eyes is fucked up.
Or Ellen Burstyn. But imagine giving it to a man like Jason Blum who doesn't understand anything about the original, and this is what you
imagine giving it to a man like David Gordon Green who doesn't understand shit about horror.
Nope. And what you get is dog shit filmmaking, the body in the blood. You just get
body in the blood, the body in the blood.
You get horrible fucking child acting, you get Leslie Odom Jr. working with nothing, you have character arcs that are incomplete, and you have all of this just setting up for that trilogy that they want to make, which I don't know if it will. It didn't make as much as you thought.
Really?
Yeah,
I didn't check the box office. Once I watched the movie and hated it, I kind of just let it go. Yeah.
It's so bad, because if you love The Exorcist... like
which I do.
Yeah, and you know it's one of those like time classic movies, movie that will be studied for years to come versus this. You know you fucked up. And you know when everybody's hating on it on Twitter and you can't find anything to post positive about it, you fucked up.
Hayden told me a story about going to Halloween Horror Nights, him standing in line with his dad, waiting to get into one of the haunted houses.
The Exorcist Believer house, yeah.
Yeah. And then your dad was like, hey, has anyone seen the movie? And one of the guys just turned around and goes, yeah, it sucked.
Yep.
And I was like, yeah, that's about what I expected.
That was the biggest problem is after, like, I hadn't seen the movie yet, obviously, but like going through the haunted house, I'm like, man, none of that made sense. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if the movie's going to clean up. And nope. It barely relates to the haunted house.
Yeah. So the whole time, you know, Halloween ends, they were promoting this as a trilogy. They were promoting this shit as a trilogy. And they really shouldn't make it a trilogy. If they were going to do a trilogy, I would prefer a full adaptation of the original book.
Exactly.
Because at least then the book has more story to tell. There's more character development of all of these different characters, rather than developing just, you know, Father Karras and fucking what's her goddamn name, Linda Blair,
Reagan,
the
ADR Reagan at the end.
Oh yeah, dude. But yeah, this fucking movie was garbage. It was the original was so grounded.
Yeah,
obviously they didn't have the effects.
It didn't even have a Christian message in it. It's just a woman pushed to like, what could she do? But yet this one's like, isn't it great we all go to church and we all believe in something? And I'm like, did you miss the point of the original? The original's not like an uplifting Christian message. It's literally about like a woman being pushed to her like limits.
Yes, that's the whole thing. It's a woman who is desperate to save her child. She's going to doctors. She's going to psychiatrists. She's going to anyone that is recommended to
and
her.
And it's not a bad
and her
thing.
Her last resort is going to a fucking priest and being like, I need an exorcist. And even the priest is like, no, you fucking don't need an exorcist.
Yeah, literally. And like this movie, what is the conclusion they come to? We need an exorcist.
And the deaths of Father Karras and fuck.
Wow, such a big fan.
Yeah, dude, I love the movie.
Yeah,
The death of the priests is it's a heart-wrenching moment because you know we felt the passion of these characters. In this movie, a priest walks in, gets his neck snapped. And that's it.
Yeah.
The whole thing was, oh, I don't have permission from the church to do this. And then he just does it anyways and gets his neck snapped. Like, what the fuck's going on, people? At least the fucking original movie, they had a director who got killed.
Yeah.
And that was a strong thing because this director was directing the movie that Ellen Burstyn's character was in.
Yeah.
So by killing the director, fucking Reagan has spiraled her mom's career as well.
Yeah.
Wow, it's almost like the fucking book had a point. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. Yeah, so that's the worst of. I'll go over that real quick again for y'all. It's fine, I can read them. But the 3 out of 10s. So number 10, Operation Rouge de Gare. Number 9, The Flash.
Operation
number
Rouge
8.
The Bat?
Yeah. Number 9, The Flash. Number 8, Cocaine Bear. Number 7, The Machine. And then the 2 out of 10s. Meg 2 at number 6. Number 5, Ant-Man Quantumania. Number 4, 80 for Brady. Number 3, FNAF. Number 2, Rebel Moon. And number 1, The Exorcist Believer.
Which I gave you, you believe a, you gave a half star, right?
Oh, yeah. It's moved down. Yeah, I fucking hated it.
Yeah, it sucks.
It's a horrible movie. It's horrible. But, yeah, that's the top 10 best and worst of 2023. Going into 2024, I fucking don't know. The strikes kind of hammered everything, so we're getting Jason Statham Beekeepers or... Argyle, whatever the fuck that's supposed to be.
Argyle, man, that fucking looks so bad.
It does.
It's disappointing because I like some of the people in
Some of the people in it, yeah. But like, well, obviously we won't be back to review most of these unless, again, they're so bad to talk about. But
2024 will be the 5-year anniversary.
Oh, it will be. But
so there, I'm not putting anything in
Stone. Yeah, yeah,
but obviously there's a very real chance that we could at least talk about.
There would be one review maybe, but we'll have to find
it's
that.
It's got to be The Exorcist.
The Exorcist 2.
Yeah, when the next Exorcist movie comes out in 2024.
Oh, so
if it comes out next year.
Yeah. So have a happy new year, everybody. We will try after this.
This is Hayden's thing. I know we've had that running bit of me owning the podcast, but this has been Hayden's thing for at least the past 4 years, coming up on 5 next year. And you know, it's been fun doing it. You know,
yeah.
there have been the rocky times. There have been the all that, but it's been fun doing it. And you know, if Hayden makes a decision to ever come back to do another movie, that's when we'll do it.
Yeah. So that being said, enjoy your happy new year. Be sure to, you know, tell me what your top 10 best and worst were. Like I said, these will be on Letterboxd. Expect the top 10 best to change on my Letterboxd after seeing Poor Things, and then obviously we'll see where things rank after that. But this, as of recording, is my top 10 best and worst, and I don't think worst is going to change because there's not really anything else.
The Exorcist Believer is always going to be bad.
Yeah,
you cannot change that.
You cannot change that. Not in the slightest. But thank you guys for listening. I hope you enjoyed this little present that we're giving to you. We'll see you.
Happy 2024.
Yeah.